So we'll begin by finishing the lecture on complexity of class structure, which we just began. I think what my strategy will be to try to do this before the break, and then to begin the lecture on gender and class, which really in previous years was two lectures. I think it would be best to have this be the rest of today and all of Monday's lecture. And Wednesday will be then the lecture on race and class, which will then end the class structure part of this double two parts on class structure and class formation. Okay. On your papers, by the way, I'm about two-thirds done. I'm having a good time. I think that they range from good to excellent so far. There's none that I felt required a huge struggle on my part just to figure out what you were talking about. So that's kind of the bottom line issue for this kind of a class. As long as I don't have to struggle to figure it out, then I can have a good time just talking to you in your paper. And there, all the ones I've read so far are clearly above that stumble over the exposition threshold. So I'll definitely have those back by Monday. And if I do get them all done, you know, tomorrow or the next day, then I might email them rather than bring them in on Monday, but I'll decide that. Okay, complexity. Does everybody have outlines, by the way? Okay. I shouldn't have. Let's see. These are all the outlines for the next one. I have one outline left. So let me see where we were. Where we began last time was, first of all, some very brief comments on what complexity is all about and why this is something to think about and to worry in general in working with concepts and theories to figure out what the appropriate level of complexity is for the explanatory task in question, and to avoid, just to repeat myself from last time, the simplistic criticism that gets often made about theoretical arguments and explanations that the world is more complex than the explanation. Hopefully the world is more complex than your explanations, otherwise you haven't succeeded in producing interesting explanations, as an overstatement. In terms of class analysis, or the analysis of class structure, there are two kinds of complexities around which my work focuses, and I think broadly one can think of this as two broad classes of complexities in the literature. One has to do with the complexities in the nature of the positions themselves that people fill, and the other is complexities in the ways people's lives get attached to positions. So to take just in a kind of an extreme caricature of possibilities, one could imagine a class structure in which there was a lottery that essentially allocated people to positions. It could even be a lottery, to just take an extreme, this would be kind of science fiction-y, but it could be a lottery where everybody had an equal chance. So at age 10 or whatever age was considered the appropriate age for the lottery, everybody had a random chance of becoming a capitalist, going into the capitalist class and being properly trained to do that well, going into the working class or being marginalized. You could just have it completely random. That would be a pretty bizarre way of allocating people to positions, but it would constitute a clear distinction between the social processes which produce the positions and the social processes which allocate people to those positions. In fact, these tend to get much more deeply connected, specifically because of the way families are situated with respect to class structures. You know, and that's this extremely interesting and complicated aspect of a class analysis, is how families get located both structurally with respect to the nature of positions and how families organize the lives of people in allocating people to those two positions. In some kinds of class structures, the connection between families and class structures are very, very tight. We think of feudalism that way, where the aristocracy, the very position, is directly transferred through family lines. Capitalist class structures have a much looser connection between family and class structures. And that's part of the complexity, then, of these particular kinds of class structures. Okay, complexities of positions and complexities of the way lives get connected to positions. My basic work in class analysis has been mostly focused on the first of these problems, how to add complexity to the analysis of class structure, of the positions which people fill. I have done relatively little work on how people get sorted into positions. You know, I haven't been particularly interested in studying class mobility. And I've had some work on other ways that people's lives are complexly connected to class structures, aside from the nature of the positions themselves. So I've worked on both sides of this complexity, but mostly most of my work and the work which I'm most identified with has been centered on the complexity of positions problem. The heart of this has been around the middle class. That's what provoked this in the first place. So I believe I mentioned the kind of biographical origins of this. As a grad student, I wanted to do a dissertation that would be the kind of study which would force mainstream sociology to take Marxist analysis seriously. So I didn't want to do a project that was purely an internal discussion within Marxism. I wanted to do a project which brought Marxist categories into the heart of conventional problems that sociologists study. And stratification seemed a natural place to do that. That is, prior to this, my main work had been around theories of the state, but I thought at that time that that would be a harder way of bringing Marxist ideas into the center of sociology and kind of challenging the mainstream in that way. I had these sort of fantasies of the time. This was part of the heroic feeling that we had as graduate students in that period, you know, of doing hand-to-hand combat with bourgeois sociology, and by the sheer force of brilliant work and decisive results, convince everybody to change sides. You know, it had this paradigm battle kind of illusion as to what this was all about. So the project I decided with my friend Luca Perrone, who's a grad student with me at Berkeley, what we decided to do was to study income inequality and to say that conventional sociology has looked at occupational status as the main stratification logic and looked at the way status is related to income. We wanted to do a class analysis of income inequality and then do a head-to-head confrontation with the occupational approach and show that class was a more powerful way of doing it. That is, class could explain everything that occupation explained and then some other things. So it was meant to show that there was kind of more powerful way of thinking about these problems, which would make sense also of the occupational findings. So it wasn't saying those are illusions, but would add additional power. To do that, we had to deal with some very practical questions. We had various surveys on which we were going to use for our data analysis, and we had to figure out how to classify people into Marxian class categories. Once we began thinking about that, we immediately realized we had a prior problem to the operational one. The operational problem is, how do you take the questions on a survey and squeeze them into your theoretical categories? But we immediately saw we had a bigger problem, which was clarifying the theoretical categories into which we wanted to squeeze the operational categories. And in particular, there's this problem of the middle class. What do you do with engineers, professors, teachers, managers, all sorts of positions in the class structure, which somehow just don't seem to feel comfortably fit comfortably with the ordinary polarized notion of capitalist class relations. Some of these are particularly uncomfortable. Managers were especially in a kind of awkward position with respect to class analysis, since managers and ordinary workers were so often in sharp conflict. And to say, well, the managers are in sharp conflict with workers reflects the false consciousness of managers, just didn't seem like a compelling way of understanding the nature of those positions. What I wanted to do, or what Luke and I wanted to do, was to deal with this problem in a way that took seriously two kinds of constraints on the possible solutions we could come up with. So this is the kind of trick of concept formation, not trick, but the kind of logic of concept formation that makes it a hard thing to do. Why concept formation isn't just a question of scratching your head and, you know, thinking of some new concepts that you throw into the stew, as it were. We wanted the new concept to be fully consistent with the abstract theory of class and exploitation within Marxism. So what we wanted to do is generate a more concrete concept, a concept that would move down to this lower level of abstraction where we wanted to study real people and income determination, but which was a coherent derivation, a coherent move from the more abstract to the more concrete. So that from a conceptual point of view, you could see how this concept fits in with the more abstract formulations of the theory. So we wanted a non-arbitrary or systematic derivation of more concrete concepts with the more abstract concepts. That was one criterion. And the other is that we wanted the solutions to be empirically coherent. That is, we wanted them to actually generate results which made sense and which generated new insights. That's what I mean by the double constraint. Constraining your innovations, your suggestions, your new ideas about concepts, constraining them both with respect to the larger theory into which they are to fit and the empirical observations which get generated using those concepts. In doing this, one has to be constantly attentive to the gaps. Now, my initial, sort of aspiration was to have full coherence with the more abstract theory, plus powerful analytic, coherence with respect to the empirical observations. It's never as simple as that. There's many reasons why it's not as simple as that. So part of the task is at each step of the way, trying to figure out, okay, where have I made compromises with the more abstract theory? Where is there actually a gap between the more abstract theory and the more concrete one, rather than ignoring those gaps? And where are the empirical results that don't seem to make sense, given the concepts in theory? Now, this is an iterated process. You try certain things, you experiment with it, you rethink the theoretical ideas in light of the experiments, do more empirical work. Repeated failures can then shake one's confidence in the larger theory of which the more concrete concepts are functioning. So it's not that a negative result and empirical problems refute the larger theory, but they do raise your anxieties about the larger theory, or should. So one solution at the end is just to abandon the whole enterprise and say, wait, this is impossible. It gives me too many headaches. And then either opt for an alternative theory within which to work if one's available, or to kind of abandon that higher level of abstraction altogether. Now, that's a common result. I mean, a lot of post-Marxists, as it were, what they've done is they've abandoned the larger theoretical framework and have a much more eclectic patchwork kind of theoretical structure that they work with. Where they draw a little bit from Weber, a little bit from Durkheim, a little bit from Bourdieu, and they just put it together without worrying about how it all fits together. Now, Now, that on one hand seems like a sort of cowardly way out, but I don't think eclecticism and a retreat from theoretical ambition should be rejected out of hand as an inappropriate thing to do. It's possible that that's the best you can do at a given point in time, and it's better to get on with business and study things and generate empirical insights, even if you can't reconstruct some grander theoretical framework. Sometimes that's the best thing to do. And by sometimes, I also mean for some people, for some, you know, some scholarly endeavors will just get stuck in a rut if you're constantly worrying about their contribution to and coherence with some grand theoretical framework. One could say, I think, as a perhaps overgeneralization, in the last quarter century or 30 years or so, there's generally been a retreat from grand theory. You know, by and large, most of scholarship no longer tries to continually re-embed itself within grand frameworks. There are some gestures at that, but mostly people aren't doing that anymore. That was what we did, or many of us tried to do in the early to late 70s and into the 80s. That's no longer the typical impulse. People are much more concerned with sorting out specific empirical problems in which they eclectically draw from different theoretical traditions to get the ideas to play with in those empirical settings. That may be the right way to go. You know, it may be that that's a healthier, more tractable kind of research program than one that has these greater ambitions. Periodically, we see the resurfacing of more framework-building kinds of approaches, the Bourdieu fad of the 80s and, well, the 90s into the early 2000s, I think, had a bit of that character. But in the end, I think the Bourdieu stuff doesn't really cohere as a whole framework. It's basically a menu. It's more like a menu of concepts than it is a comprehensive paradigmatic framework in the way that Marxism attempted to be. So there's ebbs and flows of this stuff. My ambitions, though, were unequivocally to produce a concept capable of understanding the middle class, giving it theoretical specificity, which would still be coherent with respect to the grander theory. I had two approaches to this. So one that I developed in my dissertation and my early work with Luca Perrone in the mid-70s, which this approach was the sort of dominant way that I worked on these problems into the early 80s. And then through my discussions in the analytical Marxism group, or the no-bullshit Marxism group, as we called ourselves, which started in 1981, in my discussions in that group and my debates and engagements with the work of John Romer, I thought through a second proposal, a second way of thinking through this complexity. And then there's a kind of, if we call the first one version 1.0 and the second one version 2.0, there's not a version 3.0, there's a sort of version 2.5, as it were, sort of a half an additional version, which is a kind of packaging in a different way of the first two together, sort of a re-melding of the two in a more relaxed way than either of the first two versions. So let me just give you the synoptic account of the two approaches. So the first approach has the following simple idea. Classical treatments of class have always assumed that every social location is in one and only one class. So to use a slightly different language, there's a one-to-one mapping between jobs, that is the actual positions people fill, and classes. And the task is to identify in what class a job falls. The first version says, let's drop that assumption. Let's assume that some positions which people fill, the actual positions, locations, within the social relations of production, some locations are simultaneously in more than one class. Simultaneously in more than one class. Some locations are simultaneously in more than one class. Well, how would we have to think about the nature of the relations in order for that idea to make sense? And it became clear that what you have to do when you think about relations is to break with the idea that relations are one-dimensional. What we call a social relation is actually a complex combination of many dimensions. There's many kind of relational aspects of the interactions. So remember, relations are this very tricky idea, social relation. It's not a simple idea. If you think of the relata of relations as the practices of people, it's the nature of the activities that people engage in which the activities are systematically structured in relation to the activities of others. And that's what renders the practices of different people relationally connected. But then you can see that there's clusters of practices which can have more than one type of relation with other clusters of practices. And in particular, with respect to class relations, we might want to distinguish, for example, the domination relations that bind together one set of practices with another, and the exploitation relations that bind together one set of practices with another. In the more abstract version, these coincide. So every exploiter is a dominator, and every exploited is dominated. Right? So we have a simple correspondence between these two kinds of relations. Now, how should we talk about this? We can say these two aspects of class relations. You know, I'm thinking of these, you know, in this kind of visual, that's a relation, here are the practices, right? Or the people, you can think of it either way. One language is we have a class relation that has two dimensions, or we can say class relations are actually a bundle of relations that get packaged together in different ways. At the most abstract level, they correspond. And there's really two relations, relations of domination and relations of exploitation. That contrast is captured in lots of ordinary speech about class issues. For example, it's been a classic problem in class analysis to talk about the unity or separation of ownership and control. You know, that was a classic way of talking about the problem of the corporation. How do we think about managers and CEOs in a corporation? Well, they control the activities, they're in the positions of domination, but do they own it? So there's this problem, the separation of ownership and control. The boards of directors are the representatives of the owners, the CEO are the top of the management structure. Do or do not boards of directors really control the top directors, managers? Is there a separation of ownership and control where managers are acting on the basis of their power based on control, quite independently of the power based on ownership? Well, that's a debate. That's a long-standing discussion about the nature of corporations. Once you get owners separated from the people who exercise control, there is this principal agent problem, as it's called, between owners and managers. That's a common way of talking about things in the sociology of organizations. That reflects the same very point, that the class relation between capital and labor actually is more than one kind of relation. And the formula that I kind of used was, for this first version, was to separate out the domination aspect and the exploitation aspect. That then opens up the possibility that there's all sorts of locations in the class structure where when you get to the more concrete level, where these don't coincide in some simple way. And managers was the kind of simplest case. So managers have the character of simultaneously dominating workers. So they occupy the capitalist location with respect to workers, but being dominated by the owners of capital. So they are in the working class position with respect to owners, but in the capitalist class position with respect to workers. with respect to exploitation, for that category of managers, in the earlier version, argued that they were workers insofar as they were exploited by capitalists. They worked for a wage, were separated from the means of production, and could be fired. I did not, in that earlier formulation, think through very much the sense in which they might themselves be exploiters of workers. So it was mostly on the domination dimension, was on that aspect of the relations, that I located the specificity of the managerial position. And the key idea here was then breaking with the isomorphism. That's another bit of jargon, isomorphism. It refers to when you can map one set of ideas or concepts, or in this case positions, onto another. Isomorphism means a direct one-to-one mapping. So I was rejecting the thesis that there was an isomorphism between locations and classes. Some classes could be in more than one position. So what I this playing out this first strategy, then the essential way of actually playing it out then as a basis for an empirical work was to say, okay, first we have to do is define the basic class locations of a class structure. And then, once those are defined, we can look at the contradictory locations. That is, the locations that combine relational attributes of the basic class positions. I then defined three basic class positions, not two. The capitalists were owners of the means of production and employers of workers. Workers were separated from the means of production and worked for capitalists. And the petty bourgeoisie were owners of the means of production that didn't employ anybody. They were self-employed. I argued that the petty bourgeoisie were not really part of the capitalist mode of production, so this involved an additional complication, that class structures are also combinations of forms of production. And what we had is what in Marxian terms is called simple commodity production, where direct producers own their own means of production and produce for a market directly, the small farmer or artisan being the classic case. They're not capitalists because they don't employ labor. They're not workers because they don't work for capitalists. In ordinary language, we call them self-employed. The Marxian term for it was the petty bourgeoisie. So the petty bourgeoisie was the single class in a different mode of production, simple commodity production. Capitalists and workers were the basic classes of capitalist production. And then I was able to define three contradictory class locations, which were forms of combination of these. Managers were contradictory class locations combining capital and labor. Small employers were contradictory locations that combined the petty bourgeoisie and the capitalist class, small employers being defined as employers who work alongside their workers, who do the same work as their workers. So it's not, the smallness is not so much a purely scalar issue, although for operational terms we use the number of employees. But when you think about a small bakery where the owner also is baking along with the workers, or a small farm where the farmer is actually farming along with the hired hands, that's a different kind of location in the class structure than an agro-business owner who owns huge agricultural properties and runs them for profits, or a baking, Pillsbury that has baking factories, and the owner of Pillsbury is a different kind of class position than a small bakery. The fact that the small baker hires a few people makes it a different class location from the purely self-employed person, because they are now in a class relationship with those workers. But they're also like workers in that they're direct producers. So small employers combined the petty bourgeoisie and the capitalist class. Managers combined the capitalist class and the working class. And what I called semi-autonomous employees, professionals, teachers, professors, engineers, people who had lots of control over their own work, but nevertheless worked for employers, combined aspects of the petty bourgeoisie and working class. Namely, with respect to the domination relation, they weren't really fully dominated. They were only partially dominated by their employers because they had control over their own work, in the way that a self-employed petty bourgeois has control over their own work. So the way I drew the I'm a fairly visual person in terms of the way I think about theoretical ideas. And once I got a picture, then I knew I had something I liked. So we had the bourgeoisie, or the capitalist class, the working class, and the petty bourgeoisie, okay? So these are our three basic classes. This is the capitalist mode of production, and this is simple commodity production. So we have two different kinds of modes of production. You know, so these are different kinds of class structures. And then between here we had managers. So managers are simultaneously working class and bourgeoisie. A Venn diagram, except it gets too messy, but you know, a Venn diagram where you do it this way. This is workers, these are capitalists, and these are managers. It's another way of expressing the simultaneousness of it. This small employers were here. They were have a combination of bourgeoisie, petty bourgeoisie, and semi-autonomous employees were here. This was my first framework. This was the framework I used in my dissertation. It's the framework that I used in the book Class Crisis in the State, and in the empirical work that I did until the early 1980s. Right from the start, even in my, you know, the first things I published using this, I recognized that there were certain problems with this framework, certain ways in which it just didn't quite remain faithful to the broader theoretical framework, and in which it generated empirical problems of various sorts. The empirical problems became much clearer when I launched the class analysis project. So the first big research project I did after graduate school was a survey funded by NSF that tried to put these concepts directly into operational form. In my dissertation, I had to use already existing data and squeeze the data into these categories. The data didn't really have good data on managerial positions and didn't have really adequate ways of measuring this autonomy dimension, the semi-autonomous employees. So I proposed a survey where I would directly measure all of these concepts with multiple indicators. And then be able to do a empirical investigation using the operationalization of the actual conceptual framework. So that was the objective of that first project. Once I was actually doing that in a careful and concentrated way, a range of empirical problems became clear. Now, the main theoretical problem was that the emphasis in this analysis was mainly around the domination aspect of class. That is, managers were most clearly definable with respect to domination relations. Semi-autonomous employees, the autonomy idea is a domination concept. Autonomy is with respect to domination. And even small employers was more about domination, that is the although there was a kind of exploitation dimension there. But with respect to the managers and semi-autonomous employees, the whole exploitation idea had been marginalized. And so I was dealing then with a set of operational categories, which turned out to be quite powerful. You know, that is, it did work. It did generate really good and interesting results. But they didn't fully fit with respect to what was most distinctive about the Marxian concept. The most distinctive feature of the Marxian concept is the centrality of exploitation. That's really what drives the concept. But exploitation didn't appear in the analysis. So that was the gap between on the conceptual constraints. On the empirical side, it just turned out to be devilishly hard to give precision to the autonomy idea and to, you know, to really define what it was about that that was giving a distinctive class character to a location, rendering it a contradictory class location. You know, it would turn out, for example, that janitors scored very high on autonomy scales because mostly janitors do their work by themselves, not directly supervised, and have lots of control over exactly what they do within the narrow confines of what the job entails, right? Whereas it's not so obvious that jet airplane pilots have much autonomy. You know, they're highly technically trained. There are moments where they have to make decisions, of course, but they also really have to follow the book. You know, they have a checklist. They have to do the damn checklist in that order. It seemed a little weird to be saying that the jet airline pilots was a more proletarianized position than the janitor. But part of that weirdness comes from not considering the exploitation dimension. That is, for defining their position strictly in terms of this question of autonomy, and then understanding autonomy in a way that wasn't exactly clear how much it had to do with the technical division of labor and how much it had to do really with social relations. So that was where there was empirical problems as well. All of this then meant that I was itchy for, I was worrying, you know, it creates anxiety. If you, I mean, I don't mean I was stress-ridden, sleepless nights, but, you know, if you, if you think a lot about these problems and you're reflexive, so you want to avoid self-delusion, you become more and more tuned into the ways in which the ideas aren't working well enough, and you want to push it forward. Well, that's when I encountered the work of John Romer. You know, very interesting and provocative theorist, incredibly clever. He has repeatedly, in different contexts, come up with super ingenious ways, from the point of view of the way economists play their game, of solving particular problems. Well, he wrote this book about exploitation in 1981 or two. He was part of this No Bullshit Marxism group, which met every year, where we read each other's work and relentlessly destroyed each other's work. You know, it's the only academic setting that I go to regularly, where when I'm presenting a paper, I have a little anxiety about it, you know, because you have to kind of steel yourself to the level of demolition. The style of the discussion is entirely flaw-centered. You know, it's not one-upmanship. It's an interesting, it's a very interesting group. You know, it'd be nice to have it studied by somebody from the outside. It's a very interesting group, which at first appearance looks incredibly aggressive, but there's actually no personal rivalries at all in the group. Nothing but the deepest respect and solidarity and kind of mutual support. There's no one-upmanship. It's never a case of anybody wanting to show how smart they are and how stupid the other person is. That's just not what's going on. But what goes on is a relentless search for where the weak points in an argument are and then beating it to death, right? So it's almost never the case that I've left a discussion in which my paper was the object of analysis in the group where I haven't felt some discouragement. There is a discussion of this in the preface to Envisioning Real Utopias, because an earlier version of my taking the social and socialism seriously, an earlier version of that I presented at this group, I had presented a version of that argument at a conference, an earlier conference in the summer, where everybody just thought it was great. I got nothing but positive, you know, responses for how interesting and how much I was on the right track. And I presented at the No Bullshit Marxism group, and the thing gets completely torn to shreds as having just unredeemable flaws. I mean, it was the kind of... It was super discouraging, because it was at this pivotal time in the development of the work where I really needed to settle down on a framework in order to then write the rest of the book, to put all the pieces together. And I left that meeting feeling the thing had just unraveled. But, you know, in fact, I then really thought hard about where the criticisms were and felt there was a way to do an end run around them, that is to kind of cabin off the problem that was so exercising people in the group. And it actually then helped to consolidate a framework that was not just less vulnerable to criticism, but which was cleaner with respect to the issues in play. Well, I had been presenting my stuff there. I had been getting hammered around the fact that it was all about domination, where was exploitation. Then John Romer presents his exploitation perspective. What John wanted to do was to define classes independently of the concept of exploitation and then demonstrate that indeed they were exploitative. So his approach was not to say what's distinctive about the Marxian concept of class is that classes exploit each other. He didn't want to make that part of the definition of classes. He wanted to define class relations in such a way that exploitation had nothing whatsoever to do with its definition. But then you could prove that they were exploitative. He wanted exploitation to be a derivation from a purely property relations-based definition of class. And that was a pretty interesting idea, I thought. It wasn't the way sociologists who worked in these things thought about it, but it struck me as nice to treat exploitation as a discovery, as it were, about the ramifications of a social relation, rather than as part of the definition of the social relation itself. That was essentially his approach. He did this through a set of methods that were bound up with game theory and various other, you know, economics techniques. I won't go through in detail, I won't go through at all Romer's own formulations. They're hard. They're actually not that hard. It's just that to get into it, if you haven't done this sort of stuff, is a little daunting. From my eventual point of view, that is when I get my own new perspective worked out, what Romer is actually demonstrating is what I call economic oppression, not exploitation. That is, his particular way of approaching it simply shows the inverse interdependent welfare of categories. But his approach does not distinguish between a situation where one group benefits at the expense of another by virtue of their exclusion from access to resources, that's the property rights aspect, from them also benefiting from the appropriation of surplus generated through those relations. He doesn't distinguish those two for various reasons. He thinks they shouldn't be distinguished, whereas I think they should be distinguished, but that's a separate matter. His approach, though, then led me to think about the questions I'd been addressing in a different way. Because in John's work, he introduces an idea of what he calls skill exploitation. So in his basic view, what he does is he says, let's take an asset which is unequally distributed in a population. So the asset has unequal distribution, which is enforced through property rights. And then let's ask the question, if one group leaves that set of relations with their per capita share of the assets, not just with the assets they actually have, but with their per capita share, will they be better off? And will the people they leave behind be worse off? That's his test for whether in the relationship they're exploited. If you leave the relation with your per capita share of the resources. And he plays the game in different ways. Sometimes it's what happens if you leave just with your share of the resources? What happens if you leave with your per capita share of the resources? Who's better off and who's worse off? And that counterfactual, who's better off and who's worse off, is the test for the nature of the exploitation, in his view, within the relation. Well, he did that test with respect to skill and concluded that skilled people with skills exploit people without skills. Because if the unskilled were to leave the game with their per capita share of the skill assets of the society, they would be better off than they were staying in the game. And if they were to leave the game with their per capita skill assets, the people who stay in the game would be worse off. There's more to his approach than just that, but that was the basic idea. But that suggested to me, well, maybe these semi-autonomous employees, maybe I should think of them as skill exploiters. Maybe that's what I should do. But what do I do about managers then? And I thought, well, maybe they're organization exploiters. Maybe they're able to exploit, that is, grab part of the social surplus by virtue of their organizational power. And that then led me to think, all right, well, maybe what we should do is think of the whole problem this way, that there's a collaborative, complex process of production which generates collaboratively a social surplus, and then different mechanisms by which different people in the system get a piece of the surplus. So what I redefined exploitation as the mechanisms by which people get part of the surplus, get access to the surplus. So you have the basic setup now of the game, of my way of this, of my second version is, you have a total social structure of production within which the total social product is produced. The total social product contains a part of it that we can call surplus, and a part of it that is simply reproducing the conditions of production. Different people in the system have different ways of making claims and grabbing part of the surplus. Capitalists make claims and grab part of the surplus because they own capital. Managers claim part of the surplus because they have organizational power, which enables them to extract part of the surplus in the form of higher wages. And credentialed professionals, people who have skills that are certified through credentials, and a credential therefore creates a barrier to entry into occupations that require that credential. Credentials are a kind of property right. You know, it has a kind of property-like quality. Credentials are the basis for skilled people, people with skills, making claims on the surplus and appropriating it. What this also meant is that my concept of exploitation in this second formulation gets very close to the concept of rent in what's called a neo-Ricardian framework. Owe Sorensen, who is a sociologist, professor here in the 70s and 80s and then went to Harvard, he wrote a famous paper on exploitation as rents, where he criticizes some of my work. And essentially, this is similar to his argument about rents. It's not identical, but it's similar. In Sorensen's view, then, unionized workers are indeed exploiters because they can make a claim on part of the surplus by virtue of their ability to put closure on the labor market. So that if unionized workers create barriers to entry to jobs by virtue of their control over entry points, that enables them to raise their wages above the cost of reproducing their labor power, enables them to grab part of the surplus. Yeah.
And you mentioned something.
So pay is relevant here, absolutely. So the idea here is that there's a monetary value of the surplus. So labor produces the surplus. Whether it is labor values or not is a separate question. But the surplus is produced by people who produce. So they are the producers of the surplus. That surplus gets allocated to people through different mechanisms. The surplus is measured in dollars. It does have a monetary value. The way people get access to parts of the surplus, if they're wage earners or salaried, is by having their income be high enough that it not only covers the cost of reproducing their labor power, but enables them to have discretionary income. That discretionary income, part of their income, is social surplus in the form of wages. It means that from an economist's point of view, what it means is their wages contain a rent component. That is, there is some barrier to their wages falling to the competitive equilibrium level. There's something that prevents them from falling. The thing which prevents them from falling is a restriction on the supply of labor for professionals and other credentials. So there are mechanisms which block the supply of labor. If the supply of labor increased, it would compete down the wages of credentialed workers to the point where that rent would disappear. This is the kind of monopoly rent view of wages. So a component of wages has a rent in it. It all looks like just wages. You just get paid a certain amount. But your wages actually have two parts to it. A part that's a payment for your labor effort, and a part that's above the payment for your labor effort that comes from the scarcity of your labor, which is enforced through credentials in the case of professionals. Now, for managers, there's a different mechanism in play. And that is, because managers have power in organizations, it is necessary for the employers to gain their loyalty so that they act as faithful executors of the interests of the owners of the firm. This is the principal agent problem. Paying them wages above their equilibrium is a way of ensuring their loyalty. So they receive what I called a loyalty rent, not a scarcity rent. It's a loyalty rent, and it's a loyalty rent that comes from the fact that they have power in the organization. And that power is delegated from owners, ultimately. And owners delegate that power, and in order to ensure that the power gets executed in a responsible and effective way, aligned to the interests of employers, the holders of power are given wages above the market, what would be the competitive market rate for that kind of job. That's called a loyalty rent. And then I describe these loyalty rents and the credential rent as exploitation, because they're ways that people grabbed part of the surplus. What this meant is that in this second version of my framework, we had a different way of thinking about contradictory class locations. Now they were contradictory locations within exploitation relations, not just within domination relations. Some positions in the class structure were simultaneously exploited and exploiters. Engineers, professionals, other highly skilled workers, employees, were skill exploiters, but capitalistically exploited. Managers were organizational exploiters, but capitalistically exploited. And that created then a different way of locating positions in the class structure. The middle class then could globally be thought of as those locations in the class structure which were simultaneously exploiters and exploited. Whereas the working class were exploited and capitalists were exploiters, the middle class were both exploited and exploiter. And that was the central idea of my second solution to the problem. It implied that within the middle class there was a kind of vague gradient between people who could be called net exploiters or net exploited. So some people in the middle class were more capitalistically exploited than they were skill exploiters. That is, the rent and their component didn't make up for all of the exploitation that had occurred through capitalist mechanisms. CEOs are net exploiters. That is, the rent component of their wages are way above any capitalistic exploitation that they're subjected to. Whereas lower-level managers and foremen are net exploited. That is, they are more capitalistically exploited than they are organizational exploiters. And that gradient, therefore, became part of the way of thinking about the potential coalitions between workers and various contradictory class locations. That is, the more a contradictory location is net exploited, the more its interests are aligned with workers. The more it is a net exploiter, the more its interests will be aligned with capitalists. And that was then the second general framework that I used to approach the problem of what's middle about the middle class. Well, that second solution also had lots of problems, which some of which I discussed in the initial work where I published this. Skill exploitation remained a problem. You know, previously autonomy was the problem. Now skill exploitation was a problem. How do you actually decide when the kinds of skills a person has is such as to render their wages containing a rent component? It's not at all clear how you could do this, what the operational meaning of skill exploitation would be. Simple credentials just didn't seem satisfactory. You know, credentials get thrown around all the time and it doesn't always pay off. So the concept remains slippery. It was also the case that the skill exploitation idea had a less clear relational character. Who were they exploiting, after all? All right, so capitalist exploitation is clear. Workers produce the surplus, capitalists appropriate it. Who are skill exploiters exploiting? Because they're also contributing to the surplus. So to call it exploitation just wasn't clear. Maybe the right way to think about it is that skill exploiters are just less exploited capitalistically. That is, what they're doing is able to re-grab some of the surplus which they contribute to. And to call that skill exploitation just didn't seem right. It didn't seem like it was capturing the essence of their situation. They were privileged with respect to capitalist exploitation. But being privileged with respect to a relation of exploitation isn't the same thing as being an exploiter. And it certainly didn't seem right to say that the skill exploiters were exploiting unskilled labor, because there's no reason to believe that there was actual transfers from unskilled to skilled in the higher wages of skilled. The transfers could be better thought of as a transfer from the capitalist class to the skilled labor. That is, capitalists were having to pay a premium for these workers, and the premium meant that they were less able to exploit them. So they were privileged, but privilege didn't seem to be best captured by saying they were exploiters. So these are the kinds of problems with my second solution. Headaches. So the final, you know, the denouement of all this is sort of my current solution, as it were, which is discussed in Class Counts. So Class Counts is written in 1987. My second version is published in 1985. My first version in 1976. So, you know, sort of roughly every decade. Thank God I stopped in 1997. Otherwise, I'd be due for another version by now. What I did is I retreated from the second version in Class Counts. I retreated from it and said, look, I'm going to just have a more relaxed attitude towards these categories and not worry as much that everything is neatly derived from the more abstract to the more concrete level. And it's much more of a, it has more of the character of a jerry-rigged structure, where some kinds of positions are now treated as really strata, privileged positions within exploitation relations. That's a stratification idea. Skilled workers have privileges. They have the advantage of being less exploited by virtue of the rents in their wages. So I now treat skilled labor as a stratification within the working class. So what's called the middle class is the privileged segment of the working class, privileged by virtue of their skills, which enable them to reappropriate part of the surplus which they contribute to. Managers, I think of as really needing to be understood in terms of domination relations as well as exploitation. So the previous idea of managers as contradictory locations within the domination aspect of class seems to me the right way to think about managers. So my earlier version seems better for managers, but adding the idea that their loyalty rents create a privilege for them as well with respect to exploitation. So they're in a contradictory class location that combines domination plus privilege with respect to exploitation. And I think, I mean, those ideas are discussed in the material which you've been given. Okay, that's the story of my approaches to the middle class. Let me just very quickly, just so we can wrap this up and then start the next unit after the break, about other kinds of complexity. So that's the way I grappled with the complexity of the positions themselves. First, dual class locations. Second, dual exploitation locations. Third, a combination of privileged strata plus dual class locations plus exploitation. So the final settling down position combines both gradational and relational ideas in mapping out class positions. But there are other kinds of complexities that I think are really crucial for understanding a class structure. First, there's the problem of mediated class locations. This, as we'll see, is really central to understanding the interconnection of gender and class. This is particularly important for families. So mediated locations are all the way in which your class interests are shaped by your social relations to other people rather than your direct relationship to the means of production. A family that contains an executive in a corporation and a school teacher is a different kind of family from one that contains a factory worker and a school teacher. The question is, do we want to say the school teacher's class position is different in these two families? So on the basis of the school teacher's own job, there's no difference in their class position. Their direct class is the same. On the basis of her indirect or mediated connections to class structures, they're very different. That person's class interests, then, I think, cannot be properly understood just in terms of their own job. Just a mistake to say that a person's class interest depends just upon what you do. It depends upon all the ways in which you're connected to the process of exploitation. And if you're married to a rich exploiter, since we live in a world in which families pool income and material interests get bound up with families, the class interests of that person become tied to the class structure via the mediated connection to their spouse. That creates complexity, a different kind of complexity. And there's the added complexity now, because families aren't all that stable, divorce is a common event, that individuals have what might be called shadow classes. A shadow class is the class you would be in the case of the dissolution of your mediated class locations. Right? So people have shadow classes, and that's an important part of the gender story as well. It's an aspect of the temporal character of class. It's what your class interests today depend upon, in part, your class position in the future, not just your class position right now in this moment. Your class interests depend upon your class position in the future. If you know with great certainty that in the future your class position is going to be much better than it is now, you're less likely to struggle for redistribution, right? You know, if all you care about is your own, well, you know, standard of living, your own interests, your own material conditions. If you fully expect to be in the managerial or capitalist class in the future, you'll be less interested in struggling now for worker rights and redistribution than if you have absolutely no expectation of that. So the future does have a shadow into the present. Well, in families, given the potential of dissolution, particularly for women, it's an issue to ask, what will be my class position if this marriage doesn't survive? That's a question which people ask, and it's one of the things that underwrites the unwillingness of women to take very long periods out of the labor force and thus kind of lose their seniority and their capacity to generate income on their own. So there's a temporal dimension to class locations. There's a mediated character to class locations. There's also an aspect of class locations that has become increasingly important, which can be referred to as the capitalization of surplus. So once you recognize that there are privileged locations in the class structure, privileged with respect to exploitation, so that there are these rent components in this wages and salaries of credentialed workers and managers, what that means is they have discretionary income. They earn more than they need to earn to reproduce their labor power. They then have a choice. They can increase their standard of living, they can just increase their consumption, or they can capitalize their income. They can take those rents in their income and turn it into capital. That is, they can invest it. And what you find is increasingly people do that. That is, high earners in the labor market are now much more than they were 50 years ago likely to have significant portfolios. A higher percentage of the population has some stock ownership, but if you go to the top 20-25%, you know, once you're in that range, there's a much bigger asset wealth in the at the 80th percentile now than there was at the 80th percentile 50 years ago. And that's because the amount of rent in their income has gone up, so they have more discretionary income which they can capitalize. Well, that creates a new kind of contradictory location. You know, I have colleagues in sociology who have million-dollar portfolios. They've got asset wealth worth $1 million. You know, that's entirely possible if you're a tenured professor at a, you know, a well-paying university. I mean, Wisconsin isn't well-paying by Harvard standards, but it's well-paying by human standards. Yeah. You know, don't share this with with the union, but professors at Wisconsin are grossly overpaid by any social justice standard. You know, there's no theory of justice that anybody that I know would actually subscribe to that justifies the income levels, earnings levels of tenured faculty at well-paying established research, R1, you know, top research universities. There's a big rent component in our wages. And people capitalize it. That's what they do. They invest. And if you do that with even remote, you know, steadfastness, it doesn't mean you have to deprive yourself of much because everybody lives fine. And it means that by the time you retire, you've got a very big portfolio. That's capitalization of surplus. That changes the class structure. It's a different kind of class structure when lots of high earners are also capital owners than a class structure in which they're not. Okay, I think we should, there are other complexities. They're discussed in the book. I think we should stop here and reconvene around 20 after, and then we can begin the gender discussion.
Yeah.